ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 33, Chapter entitled The Rasa Dance, Text Number 31. Ishvaranam Vacha Satyam
Ishvaranam Vacha Satyam
Tataiva Charitam Kvachit
Tataiva Charitam Kvachit
Tesham Yatsva Vacho Yuktam
Tesham Yatsva Vacho Yuktam
Buddhimam tat samacharet.
Buddhimam tat samacharet.
Ishvaranam.
Ishvaranam.
Of the Lord's empowered servants.
The Lord's empowered servants.
Vacha.
Vacha.
The words.
The words.
Satyam.
Satyam.
True.
True.
Tata eva.
Tata eva.
Also.
Also.
Acharitam,
acharitam,
what they do.
Kvachit,
sometimes.
Tesham,
of them.
Yat,
which.
Svabacha,
with their own words.
Yuktam,
in agreement.
And
Buddhiman,
Buddhiman.
One who is intelligent.
Tat.
That.
Samacharit.
Should perform. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. The statements of the Lord's empowered servants are always true, and the acts they perform are exemplary when consistent with those statements. Therefore, one who is intelligent should carry out their instructions. Translation responsibly. The statements of the Lord's empowered servants.
The statements of the Lord's empowered servants
are always true.
Are always true.
And the acts they perform.
And the acts they perform.
Are exemplary.
Are exemplary.
When consistent with those statements.
When consistent with those statements.
Therefore.
Therefore.
One who is intelligent.
One who is intelligent.
Should carry out their instructions. It's a long purport, so I just have to try to stay attentive. Purport. The word Ishvara is usually defined in Sanskrit dictionaries as Lord, Master, Ruler, and also as capable, potent, to perform. Srila Prabhupada often translated the word Ishvara as controller, which brilliantly synthesizes the two fundamental concepts of Ishvara, namely a master or ruler and a capable or potent person. A master may be incompetent, but a controller is a master or lord who in fact makes things happen. The Parameshwara, the supreme Ishwara, the supreme controller, is of course God, Krishna, the cause of all causes. Although people in general, especially in the Western countries, are not aware of the fact, powerful personalities control our universe. The modern impersonal concept of the universe depicts an almost totally lifeless cosmos in which the earth floats meaninglessly. Thus we are left with the dubious ultimate purpose of preserving and reproducing our genetic code, which has its own ultimate purpose of adding another link to the meaningless chain of events by again reproducing itself. In contrast to this sterile, meaningless world concocted by ignorant materialists, the actual universe is full of life, personal life, and in fact full of God, who pervades and supports all that exists. The essence of reality is the supreme personality of Godhead and his personal relationship with the innumerable living beings, of whom we are samples. Some of the living beings are trapped in the illusion of materialism, or identification with the material body, while others are liberated, aware of their eternal spiritual nature. A third class comprises those progressing in self-realization from the materialistic state of ignorance to the enlightened state of Krishna consciousness. Reality is ultimately personal and divine, and therefore it is not surprising that as the Vedic literature reveals to us, our universe and other universes are managed by great personalities, just as our city, state and country are managed by empowered personalities. When we democratically award a particular politician the right to govern, we vote for him because he has exhibited something we call leadership or ability. We think he'll get the job done. In other words, it is only after an individual acquires the power to govern that we'd vote for him. Our vote does not make him a leader, but rather recognizes the power in him coming from some other source. Thus, as Lord Krishna explains at the end of the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, any living being exhibiting an extraordinary power, ability or authority must have been empowered by the Lord himself or by the Lord's energy. Those directly empowered by the Lord are devoted to him, and thus their power and influence spread goodness throughout the world. Whereas those who are empowered by the Lord's illusory potency are in an indirect relationship with Krishna, because they do not directly reflect his will. Of course, they do reflect his will indirectly, since it is by Krishna's arrangement that the laws of nature act upon ignorant living beings, gradually persuading them through their journey of many lifetimes to surrender to the Lord. Thus, as politicians create wars, false hopes and innumerable passionate schemes for the materialistic persons who follow them, the politicians are indirectly carrying out the Lord's program of allowing the conditioned souls to experience the bitter fruit of godlessness. Srila Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur has translated the word Ishwaranam as those who have become powerful through knowledge and austerity. As one understands the nature and will of God and makes the personal sacrifice required to achieve excellence in spiritual life, one becomes empowered by the Supreme Lord to represent his will, which one has intelligently recognized and accepted. The Supreme Personality of Godhead kindly descends to earth to show a vivid example of religious behavior. As Lord Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita 3:24, if I did not execute standard duties, the whole world would be misled and in fact destroyed. Thus the Lord showed in his different incarnations how to act properly in this world. A good example is Lord Ramachandra, who behaved wonderfully as the son of King Dasharatha. But when Lord Krishna himself descends, he also demonstrates the ultimate religious principle, namely that the Supreme Lord is beyond all other living beings, and that no one can imitate his supreme position. This foremost of all religious principles, that the Lord is unique, without equal or superior, was clearly demonstrated in Lord Krishna's apparently immoral pastimes with the gopis. No one can imitate these activities without incurring dire consequences, as explained here by Shukadev Goswami. One who thinks that Lord Krishna is an ordinary living being, subjected to lust, or who accepts his rasa dance as admirable and tries to imitate it, will certainly be vanquished, as described in text 30 of this chapter. Finally, a distinction must be made between the Lord and his empowered servants. An empowered servant of the Lord, as in the case of Brahma, may experience a remnant of reactions to previous activities according to the law of karma. But the Lord is eternally free from any entanglement in the laws of karma. He is on a unique platform. Om Gyan Timanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swa Padantikam. Vancha Kalpataruvyascha Kripa Sindubhi Evacha Petitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityanando Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is ending the 33rd chapter of the Rasa Dance, or the five pastimes, where Krishna has pastimes with the gopis of Vrindavan. So now the question has been raised by Parikshit Maharaj to Shukadev Goswami. Are the Lord's activities in this Rasa Leela, are they moral activities? Because he sees that when he looks around the assembly of sages who are listening to this dialogue between himself and Shukadev Goswami, he sees that some of them have peculiar looks on their faces. In other words, they're thinking, are Krishna's activities with the gopis immoral? They haven't at this point in time, even though they've been listening for around about 6 days at this point in time to Shukadev Goswami speaking to Parikshit Maharaj, they haven't accepted within their heart that Krishna is the Parameshwara, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, because they're not accepting him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then they're questioning whether or not his activities are moral or immoral, whether they're dharmic or adharmic, or whether they're material or spiritual. They haven't come to the platform of understanding that Krishna's activities are not like activities in this material world. Now, when Krishna comes to this material world, he has three purposes, which he explains in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita: paritranaya sadunam, vinasha chaduskritam, dharmasam stapanataya sambhavami yuge yuge. So Krishna explains, I come to deliver the pious, the devotees, I come to annihilate the miscreants, and I come to re-establish religious principles. So that is one of Krishna's purposes when he comes to this material world, is to re-establish religious principles. But in the incarnation of Krishna, in terms of the pastimes he performs in Vrindavan, it becomes ambiguous. Some of the Lord's activities become ambiguous in terms of their relationship with common morality. In other words, in terms of Krishna's incarnation as Lord Ramachandra, Lord Ramachandra is Krishna incarnating as the ideal human being. And in Lord Ramachandra's activities, there is no discrepancy whatsoever. Right? Everything Lord Ramachandra does is perfect in terms of Dharma. In terms of being a son, he is the perfect son. He shows us what is the standard of being a son. In terms of being a king, he is the perfect king. He shows us the standard. In terms of being a husband, he is perfect. He shows us the standard. Right? So in every single relationship that Lord Ramachandra displays, it is the perfection of human behaviour, right? And it is completely according to the principles of Dharma. And then the source of Lord Ramachandra, or the original personality of Godhead according to the version of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is Lord Krishna himself, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. He is the original personality of Godhead. And in terms of Lord Krishna, in terms of his pastimes, when he's in Dwarka and when he's in Mathura, there is no discrepancy in his pastimes. Right? He acts as an ideal king, because in in Dwarka and Mathura, he is acting as a Kshatriya, as a prince. And he doesn't display immoral pastimes. There's nothing going against the laws of Dharma within his pastimes. Right? Everything is as it should be. But when Krishna is in Vrindavan, then there may be some conflict between what we call moral, mundane Dharma within this material world and the Lord's pastimes. Right? Because what the Lord is displaying, as is pointed out in this purport by Haridananda Maharaj, what the Lord is displaying in these pastimes is the topmost level of surrender between the Lord and in the relationship between the Lord and the Lord's devotees. Because Krishna's final instruction, or the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, is Sava Dhamman Parijyaja Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. Sava Dhamman means all Dharma, Parijyaja, rejected. Right? All Dharma must be rejected. Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. Surrender unto me alone. Krishnaika Sharana. Means to surrender to Krishna alone. In the 26 qualities of the devotee, which are given in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to Sanatana Goswami in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he mentions there are 26 qualities. Out of the 26 qualities, one of them is called Swarup Lakshana, and the other 25 are called Tatastha Lakshana. What does Tatastha Lakshana mean? Yeah, secondary characteristics. Means the secondary or auxiliary or
marginal.
Yeah, Tatastha means marginal. Or they're like embellishing characteristics, right? They're characteristics which embellish the main characteristic, right? But what is the main characteristic out of the 26? Kripalu, Akrita Droha, Sachasara, Sama. They're the first four. And there's another 22. But what is the main one out of all the 26? What is the one quality which is called Swarup, which is the essential quality of a devotee, which he must have? And if he has that quality, the other 25 will develop in his personality.
Strong faith in Krishna.
Yeah, strong faith in Krishna. But specifically, how is it termed?
Sharana,
yeah, like that. It's called Krishnaika Sharana. Right? Krishna Eka Sharana. It means surrender unto Krishna alone. Eka means one. Ekeha Kuru Nandana. Krishna, Krishnaika, Krishna Eka Sharana. Surrender to Krishna alone. Right? And when the devotee is fully surrendered to Krishna, it doesn't mean the devotee is just, you know, tunnel visioned and all he sees is Krishna, I don't see anyone else. You know, all the rest of you, you know, it's nice that you came today, but, you know, you're not really that significant because I'm seeing Krishna like that. It's not that the other personalities in creation are not significant, but Krishna is the original personality, he is the source of all personalities, and he is the principal object for everyone's love in creation. So because he is the principal object of love for everyone, then therefore, if the devotee has that particular quality towards Krishna, then all other qualities begin to manifest, right? You'll become humble, you'll become compassionate, you'll become truthful, you'll become clean, right? You'll become grave, you'll become silent, you'll develop all the other qualities of the devotee automatically, right? But you must have that quality primarily. So in the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan, what is being exemplified, especially in these pastimes, with the gopis of Vrindavan, who are the topmost devotees in existence, in creation, what is being exemplified is Krishnaika Sharana, right? It is complete surrender to Krishna, right? Even at the expense of mundane morality, right? If you're married to someone, right, and you get a phone call in the middle of the night, right, because you might hear a flute, you know, but you might not. You probably get a text message or something, and someone says, "Come and meet me. I'm waiting in the park under the trees. It's a beautiful moonlit night." Right? If you go, then you've broken dharma. You've broken the principles of dharma, and you will suffer reactions. Right? There will be sin connected to that breaking of dharma because we are bound. But within the spiritual world, the reason Krishna is displaying the pastimes like this, and it appears to be, it does contradict mundane morality, it does, right? But the reason it's conflicting mundane morality is because Krishna is showing even higher than mundane morality is his pleasure, right? Is the fact that the living entity is designed and created to facilitate his pleasure. And that is the topmost dharma, that is the perfection of religion. That is religion, actually, right? Because someone, just like in Kurukshetra, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the famous pastime is there where they need to kill Dronacharya, right? Because Dronacharya is a big obstacle for the Pandavas winning the battle. There were three big obstacles on the battlefield, right? Bhishma, Karna, and Drona. These were big obstacles. They were very difficult to defeat, these three personalities. You couldn't defeat Bhishma. There was no one in the universe who could defeat Bhishma. The only people who could defeat Bhishma were Balaram and Krishna. There was no one else in existence who could beat Bhishma in terms of his prowess. He was so powerful. Drona was the guru, right? Before the battle began, because You know, Arjuna would never even speak a disrespectful word towards his guru. He had so much love for Dronacharya. You know, there's no possible way that he'd even speak something. So before the battle took place, after Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita and the battle was just about to begin, Arjuna took an arrow and he shot the arrow and it landed at the feet of Dronacharya, right? And it was like touching his feet. It was like showing him respect. It was like, I will fight with you, right? And I will even kill you if I have to, but you are my guru. I love you, right? Even though I may have to kill you, but still, I offer you my respect. And Drona took an arrow and he shot it and it just went, just like clipped him on the head, right? Just clipped him on the head. And that was like benediction. It was like, do what you need to do. Do what you need to do. If you need to kill me, kill me. Do not hesitate. This is a battle. But I offer you my blessings. And I will kill you if I need to. Like that. That was the law. That was what I was going to. So they offered respect to each other and then the battle began. So then they couldn't defeat Drona. Right, he was just a big obstacle in the battle. And the only way they could defeat him is by saying that his son Ashwatthama had died. So therefore, they said, they were telling him, they'll say, Ashwatthama has died, Ashwatthama has died. Right? Different personalities on the battlefield were saying it. And Drona says, I do not believe you. I do not believe you. Right? He said, if Yudhisthira says it, then I will believe him, because he is Dharma Raj. Right? He is the personification of Dharma. He is the perfect king, so he will not lie. So then Arjuna and Krishna, they drove their chariot to where Yudhisthira was, and they said, please come and tell Drona that Ashwatthama is dead. And Yudhisthira, he was in great turmoil within his heart, because he'd never told a lie in his life. Right? It was just completely against his grain or against his nature to lie. Right? It was just so, they had such high quality. Like in Kali Yuga, everyone lies. Hands up if you don't tell lies, honestly. Hands up if you don't tell lies, honestly. Right? There's no one here who doesn't lie. We all lie, right? We don't have the quality of character they had previously. Right? They had such moral character and fibre within their personality. There was not even a question of telling a lie. So many people were like that previously. So that's how Kali Yuga has degenerated, the quality of human beings like that. So they brought him there and they said, tell him that Ashwatthama is dead. And he couldn't do it, he couldn't bring himself to do it. Right? So then there was one elephant called Ashwatthama. So Bhima went and killed the elephant. Right? He went, I think with his hands, he just killed the elephant, right? And during the battle, Bhima was running around because they had an elephant army, and the elephant army is very powerful. When the elephants come through the army, the foot soldiers just get crushed. You know, they destroy your phalanx because they have these phalanxes or these military formations which are very hard to penetrate. So if they want to penetrate, they send the elephants through, right? And then they just break up the phalanx. So Bhima, in order to counteract the elephant army, he'd run into the elephants where all the elephants were, and he'd start punching them in the stomach. Right, just punching them, just killing them. Right, they just die. They just fall on the ground. They just run around, just punching, smacking all the elephants. So then, Bhima went and killed one elephant called Ashwatthama, and then they came to Yudhisthira and they said, "Ashwatthama, the elephant, is dead." Right. So now, tell Drona, Ashwatthama is dead. So then, Yudhisthira, he went to Drona and he said, "The elephant, Ashwatthama, is dead." Right? So when he said the elephant, then Krishna blew the conch. Right? So then the conch died, and then he said, "Ashwatthama is dead." Right? So then Drona, he sat down on his chariot. He went into a samadhi. He just sat on his chariot, and he said, "Well, my son is dead, then I will not live anymore." Sat on a chariot, and then Drishtadyumna. Drishtadyumna came and cut his head off, just from behind, cut his head off. And all the warriors were shocked that he would do that. But Drishtadyumna was benedicted from his birth. He was created to kill Drona. He was going to be the source of his death. So, the point is that after Yudhisthira had disobeyed Krishna's order, because Krishna directly instructed him please lie on my behalf. And because he refused to follow Yudhisthira's order, then it is said that his chariot, which was riding above the earth, right? His chariot was slightly raised off the earth. Because during the battle, it is described that there were 640 million warriors, and there was so much blood, right? It's gross, but there's so much blood flowing, it was like a river of blood, right? So the ground was just muddy, and the chariots were all getting bogged down in the mud. It was very difficult for everyone to move. So Yudhisthira's chariot was always like an inch off the ground. So it was always moving, and it was unimpeded. It could move on the battlefield anywhere. It was never, because he was so dharmic and so pure, he was not even touching this material existence practically in terms of his consciousness. But when he disobeyed Krishna's order, his chariot sunk into the mud. Right? And then he touched, he became lowered in his status. So the point which is being made in this pastime is that to serve Krishna's order is even higher than mundane morality. Normally Krishna himself, and Krishna's incarnations in particular, like Lord Ramachandra, they will not contravene, or they will not go against mundane morality. Right? Because they're setting the example for us. Yad yad acharyati shrestas. Krishna says, if I do not do it, then all of you will not do it. Right? So therefore Krishna usually sets the proper example. And you'll see in Dwarka, in Krishna's pastimes, when you read in the further along in the 10th canto, when Krishna's in Dwarka, he gets up every morning when the cock crows. Right? Every morning when the cocks begin to crow. Right? At that time, he immediately gets up. Right? Which means the cocks begin to crow when dawn takes place, when the first light begins to come, before the sun rises. Right? Two muharatas before the sun rises. Then when dawn begins to manifest, the cocks begin to crow. So Krishna gets up at that time, right? Before the sunrise, the Brahma Muhurta. It is said the most auspicious time of the day is the Brahma Muhurta. What time is the Brahma Muhurta? Yeah, two muhurtas before sunrise. How long is one muhurta?
46 minutes.
Is it 46 or 48?
An average of 48.
48. Average. So 48 minutes, that's a muhurta. So two muhurtas before the sun rises, that is called Brahma muhurta. And Prabhupada writes in his purports throughout the Bhagavatam, this is the most auspicious time of day for spiritual life. If you practice hearing and chanting, particular chanting, at this time, an hour and a half before the sun rises, it is the most potent time of the day to hear and chant, to perform any bhakti or any devotional activity. It has immense potency. Right? It is more potent than any other time of the day until you become very advanced. And when you're very advanced, it doesn't matter when or where. Right? There's no hard and fast rules for chanting the holy names. But we're not very advanced, and we are quite conditioned by the modes of nature, if you haven't noticed. So that time of day is the most beneficial. Right? So therefore, we get up and we do our hearing and chanting, particularly at that time of day, and we derive the most benefit. So in Dwarka, Krishna shows everyone the example. Right? As soon as the sun begins to rise, he hears the cock crow, immediately he rises. Right? And it's said that he goes, he washes his hands, washes his mouth, shows his cleanliness, and then he begins to meditate. Right? And who does he meditate upon?
Himself.
Prabhupada says himself. Right? Because who else do you meditate on when you're God? There's no one else to meditate on. Actually, Krishna and Dwarka, from the descriptions in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Krishna and Dwarka is meditating on himself in Vrindavan. So when it says he's meditating on himself, it means he's meditating on his pastimes with the gopis in Vrindavan. Okay. So he shows in his pastimes perfect dharmic principles, right? And generally he does not go against these. But in Vrindavan, he's showing the highest religious principle. Higher than following mundane dharma is to follow the principle of surrendering to Krishna. Krishnaika Sharana, or Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja. Right? To show this topmost religious principle. That's why Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Savadaman Purujaja. Reject everything else if you are going to surrender to me fully. And if you surrender to me fully, there will be no sinful reaction for you. Moksha Yashami Masucha. Krishna says, I will liberate you from the sin. Right? Normally, if you go against your religious duties, you'll get a reaction. But if you neglect your religious duties for the higher purpose of pleasing Krishna, Krishna says, I will liberate you from the sin. You don't have to fear. So that is what is being mentioned here. So Parikshit Maharaj is asking this question to Shukadeva Goswami because he wants to clarify for the benefit of all the sages in Naimisharanya, right? What is the actual position of the Lord? Because some of them are thinking, well, the Lord has gone against mundane religious principles. He's acting immorally, right? So therefore he must be touched by the modes of material nature. Right? He must be motivated by lust, or motivated by the desire to enjoy mundane relationships with the gopis of Vrindavan. But it is obvious from the commentaries of the Acharyas that Krishna and the gopis of Vrindavan are completely liberated beyond the jurisdiction of the material modes of nature. Right? Especially because Krishna is situated in Vishuddha Sattva, which means pure goodness. And all of Krishna's eternal devotees are situated in Vishuddha Sattva, or pure goodness. So there's no contamination whatsoever in their consciousness. Now, it is described in this section by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that the devotees of Krishna, they must follow these religious principles under all... generally under all circumstances. As I'll make this point. In the purport, Hridayananda Maharaj quotes Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, and he quotes a very interesting, or he makes a very interesting comment on this verse. He says, those who have become powerful through knowledge and austerity are known as Ishwaranam. As one understands the nature of God, the nature and the will of God, and makes the personal sacrifice required to achieve excellence in spiritual life, one becomes empowered by the Supreme Lord to represent His will, which one has intelligently recognized and accepted. So in other words, the way a devotee becomes potent is by these two principles, which Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was mentioning here. The first principle is that the devotee becomes powerful through knowledge. When a devotee has a great level of knowledge, knowledge means spiritual knowledge, right? It doesn't mean knowledge of the mundane world. Like that. It doesn't mean he's an expert mathematician or an expert material scientist or an expert, you know, whatever. It means that he has to have knowledge of Shastra. And that is the definition of the word guru, or one of the definitions of the word guru. What does the word guru mean?
Heavy.
Yeah, heavy. Right? It means guru. Laghu. Laghu means light. Just like Rupa Goswami has the Laghu Bhagavatamrita and the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. Brihat means great. Laghu means light. Or so laghu, right? But guru means heavy. Just like in Ayurveda, rice is considered to be laghu, right? If you eat rice, it is laghu, it is light, right? If you drink milk, that is also laghu, that is light. If you just drink milk by itself, that is laghu. But if you mix the two together, right, that is guru, right? That is heavy, right? If you try to drink or eat sweet rice, that is heavy, right? It has very different consistency, right? Much thicker, right? So guru means that he is heavy with knowledge, right? Just like the tree. When the tree has a lot of fruit, it becomes heavy and it bows down. The branches become very weighted because there's so much fruit. Right? So we see that we can judge a devotee by the fruits which the devotee possesses. Right? And the more transcendental realization the devotee takes, then he becomes more and more qualified to become guru. Right? Because one cannot become a guru unless he has transcendental knowledge. Right? This is the main benediction which we receive from our guru. It is said, I think based on the Hari Bhakti Vilas by Sanatana Goswami, the main service that the disciple is meant to render to the spiritual master is hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam from him. That is the principal service, right? When the spiritual master comes, you must hear the Srimad Bhagavatam from him. That is the main service. Of course, there are many other services we do for the spiritual master, right? In terms of Bani and Bapu, Right? We do many services through his instructions, we follow his instructions, and we serve his personal form whenever we have the opportunity. But the main service is to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam. I remember one time when I was a new devotee, it was the year I got initiated, I think 1990, and my spiritual master came to Melbourne, and he was giving Bhagavatam class, and I was only quite a new devotee, and he was having fruit for breakfast. So myself and two of my godbrothers, one of whom was more senior than me, they said, oh, we have to prepare Gurudev's breakfast, our spiritual master's breakfast. So all three of us missed the Bhagavatam class. We were just cutting up fruit and making our own stews and cutting the bread for the toast. It only took one person to do it, but I don't know why, but three of us were doing it, and we missed the whole class. So he came into the dining room, we had everything ready, everything was pukka, perfect, because he was very particular about everything being very punctual, like that. That is the duty of the disciple. Right? The duty of the disciple is to facilitate the service of the spiritual master. Right? And the spiritual master is known as Ashraya Vigraha. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj describes the guru as Ashraya Vigraha, means the personality of Krishna who gives us shelter. Right? The guru's purpose is to train the disciple how to serve Krishna, to qualify the disciple to become qualified to enter into the service of Krishna. So therefore he trains us. Right? And that's why the guru is also another name, or another meaning of the word guru is heavy. That's why the guru will sometimes be heavy on the disciple. It's his duty to chastise the disciple, because he's trying to train us to become qualified so that one day we can serve Krishna as Krishna desires to be served appropriately in the spiritual world. It's not that in the spiritual world everyone is spaced out. Everyone's running around, oh, where's the garlands? Where's the garlands? Right? Did anyone cook the laddus? You know, quick, quick, Krishna's coming, Krishna's coming, right around he's coming, quick. Decorate the forest. Ah, right? And then as they walk into the grove, everyone's throwing ladders out and like, yeah, it's everything like, it's not, it's very organized there. Right? And the reason it's organized is because everyone is extremely competent in their service. Right? There's no rushing around, or everything is done timely and very punctual. You see Srila Prabhupada, he did more service than all of us put together. Right? But you never saw Prabhupada running here or running there, or waking up, oh, I'm late. You know, Prabhupada was never like that. Everything was just very perfect and very orderly. Why? Because he came from the spiritual world and he understood the level of service that the disciple is meant to render to Krishna. So the spiritual master trains us to be very punctual. So when Tamal Krishna Maharaj finished class, he came into the dining room and we had everything ready. Right? The fruit was there, the toast was cut, the juice was ready, everything was ready. And he came in and he said, why weren't you in class? And I was only a new devotee, and so my older godbrother really got chastised. He said, why weren't you in class? You should have known better. Right? Why does it take three of you to cut up some fruit? Right? It takes one of you 10 minutes to cut up some fruit. And so he was very heavy on us like that. Even though we had served him, you can say we were serving, but the main service that the disciple is meant to render to the spiritual master is to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam from him. Because the main benediction, or the main gift that the spiritual master is offering to the disciple is transcendental knowledge. Right? When you hear from the spiritual master, it enters the heart. Divyagyan, Hride, Prakashito. It illuminates the consciousness. So therefore we have to hear from the spiritual master. Therefore, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that the devotee becomes through knowledge and through austerity. Right? Austerity means making personal sacrifice for the pleasure of Krishna. This is spoken about in the fifth canto by Lord Rishabdev. He says, Tapo Divyam, Brahma Sokyam, Vishuddha Sattvam. Right? If you want to get spiritual happiness, Brahma Sokyam means spiritual bliss, right? On the platform of Shuddha Sattva, or pure goodness. He says the way to do that, he instructs his sons, is through Tapo Divyam. It means transcendental austerities, or austerities performed for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. This is how a devotee becomes powerful, right? And that's why our spiritual masters are empowered personalities, because they sacrifice themselves for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. And because of that, they've realized the purports of Vedic knowledge. And therefore, they are capable to give us this Vedic knowledge and to purify our hearts. Right? So, this point is made by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And in relationship to these pastimes, it may be seen that Krishna may apparently be acting immorally. Right? It may appear to some people. People will come along and they will hear this description, and people who are very attached to Dharma, which we should be. We should be attached to Dharma. You know, we should be good husbands. We should be good wives. We should be good fathers. We should be good mothers. We should be good anything. Whatever position we have, we should be very upstanding. But people will come along and they Dharma is the highest thing. Right? In India, you'll often hear this. Dharma is highest. Right? Everyone should follow Dharma. Right? If you contravene Dharma or you contradict Dharma, then you are nonsense. Right? That is considered something, and that's mundane morality. Right? But the point that Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur makes in his commentary in this section of the Bhagavatam is that devotees should become very learned themselves in Shastra. Right? We should have knowledge. Right? We should be able to understand that this is not immoral. Right? Why is it not immoral? Right? Because it is a higher sense of religion. Right, devotees should be able to explain that and understand that themselves. That's why it is imperative that devotees study the Shastra. Right? Once criticized his disciples, his followers, he said they're very good at distributing books, but a lot of the time they don't know what's in the books themselves. They don't read the books. Right? And Prabhupada said this on occasion. He said, one criticism I have of my disciples, they do not read my books. So I was talking to one devotee yesterday and she was saying to me that we hardly have time to read Prabhupada's books. You know, we're doing so much service. Right? Hands up if you feel like that. You're doing a lot of service and you don't have a lot of time to read Prabhupada's books. Yes. Right? So that's true. We all feel like that. We all have a lot of service. It's a big temple. Right? It's a big project. Right? And we're being blessed by Prabhupada to be engaged in serving this project and serving this temple and serving these deities. Right, and it's a great sacrifice, and of course, right. The amount of sacrifice it took to establish this temple was immense. Right, the amount of sacrifice it takes to maintain Radha Balava's service is immense. Right, as we all know, because we all live here. I've been to other temples in the world. There's not many temples like this one. This temple really requires a lot of sacrifice from those who voluntarily take up the service of Radha Balava in this temple. Right? It requires a great deal of sacrifice. But that doesn't mean that we don't make time to hear and chant or read Prabhupada's books, because that is also his instruction. While Krishna Maharaj was serving Prabhupada at the end of his life in 1977, the last 6 months of Prabhupada's life, Prabhupada was practically bedridden. Prabhupada was practically lying on his bed in the Krishna Balaram Mandir in Vrindavan for the last 6 months of his life. And one day, Prabhupada said, he woke up, and Prabhupada said, are you really? And Tamal Krishnamurti just looked at Prabhupada with like a look of dismay. Like, Prabhupada, how do I have time to read your books? He said, all I do is sleep for 6 hours a day. You know, I'm minimizing my sleeping as much as I can. I chant my rounds, 16 rounds. I take bath, I eat, minimally. And virtually the rest of the time, just serving you. You know, I don't have time, practically, to do anything. He says, you know, and Prabhupada said, it requires practice. Right? He said, you must reduce your eating and your sleeping. Or in other words, you don't have to reduce it. It's not like, okay, I'm sleeping 6 hours, let me go back to five. Or, you know, I'm eating twice a day, let me eat once. It doesn't mean that. It means you maintain. But it means you have to be honest. Always waste a lot of time. A lot of time being wasted. And if you use that to study Prabhupada's books, you could easily study Prabhupada's books for 1 hour a day, easily. And if you're really, really enthusiastic and determined, you could probably study 2 hours of that, if you're very serious. But at least 1 hour a day you could do. And if you study Prabhupada's books properly, then you won't take Krishna's pastimes as being ordinary. They're not ordinary. Right? There's nothing immoral about Krishna dancing with the gopis, because the gopis belong to Krishna. Right? They're not Krishna's paramours or Krishna's It's not a lusty, you know, Krishna's lusty and he wants to dance with other people's wives. It's nothing to do with that whatsoever. Right? In fact, the gopi, it's called Parakiya Bhav because Yogamaya arranges it and Krishna arranges it that he's married to others and that he's not married to them because it increases love, right? Because there's so much obstacle which needs to be overcome for them to come together in the middle of the night, and that increases the rasa. If Krishna's in Dwarka with his queens and he says, let's go out and dance in the garden, because Krishna has beautiful gardens right within the palaces of Dwarka, beautiful garden, huge garden, like forest practically, within the palace. So Krishna can say, it's a full moon night, let's go out and dance, right? And he probably does it in the spiritual world. But it's not the same, right? Because, you know, he just turns around and Rukmini's there and he says, let's go and dance. And Rukmini says, yes, okay. But when, for Srimati Radharani, they have to send notes, right? And they have Morse code. They use mirrors and they, you know, with the sun, they reflect. Right? They make like, you know, I'll meet you there tonight. Like that. That's all they do, right? So that's so much more exciting, right? And then they have to, Krishna has to go to bed and he pretends he's asleep and Mother Yashoda reads him the story, right? And she strokes him on the head just before he takes rest and he closes his eyes and pretends he's asleep and she gets up very quietly and she goes out and she closes the door, and as soon as she closes the door he just goes, right? And then he's up, right? And then one of his friends hops into his bed and, you know, puts on the blankets, right? That, or else, otherwise they must put pillows or something. And then he's out the window into the night, right? And then finally, and Radharani, same thing. She has to get through the obstacles. And it says, if the moon is full, it's all moon, they run into the forest, they wear white. So they use the moonlight, the moonbeams. And when it's Amavasya, when it's the dark moon, they wear black. They wear black cloaks so they won't be seen, they'll be dark. And they run into the forest. And in Vrindavan, that's the way they dress the deities. When it's Purnima or full moon, the deities always wear white. And when it's Amavasya or dark, they wear dark blue or blackish kind of clothes. So they dress according to the moon. So that's very exciting for Krishna. It's wonderful. So the devotees know that there's nothing immoral, right? So to say that Krishna is not married to the gopis is not correct, because the gopis belong to Krishna. Their hearts are given to Krishna. And that is the highest level of surrender. That is mam ekam sharanam vrija, they the personification. There's nothing immoral, right? They're only apparently other people who just part of themselves at all. And then the acharyas point out that if you say they're not Krishna makes arrangements that they become married. Because they're very young. Like, how old is Krishna and the gopis at this point in time?
Eight,
ten, like that. So sometimes they're in the forest. They're in the forest and they're performing pastimes somewhere in the forest. And then, because they're only young, they're like children, right? So actually, Krishna is eternally about 15. That's his Kaishora age in relationship with God. He's eternally around 15 years old. And Radharani is eternally around 15 also. Krishna's around 16, Radharani's around 15. So sometimes in the middle of the pastimes in the forest, Lalita becomes the priest, right? And she comes and she takes Radha and Krishna's hands together. And she puts them together and then she begins to tie them like in the weddings. When we do our weddings, we wrap garlands around that. So they wrap the garlands around and suddenly Radha and Krishna become very, right? And then they start chanting mantras for a wedding. You know, and then they say, you know, Radharani, do you take Krishna to be your husband? And she all giggles, you know, and she says, you know, yes I do. And then Krishna, do you accept Radha? But then they're married. Right? Who is a more qualified priest than Lalita Devi? Right? So no one can argue that they're not married, right? They are married, but they're not. So if someone says they're immoral, we say, no, they're not immoral, they're married, right? And if someone says, so it's not. And if someone says, well, they're married, we say, no, they're not. Right? That's the potency of the pastime. There's other pastimes where they're in the forest together and suddenly Lord Brahma just flies down on his swan and he lands there and then Lord Brahma gets off the swan and then he performs a marriage ceremony. Pastimes in the writings of the Goswamis where they actually do become married. But for the purpose of the pastimes, they remain unmarried. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out that devotees must become learned in Shastri, must study Prabhupada's books and the commentaries of the Acharyas carefully so that we understand Krishna properly. Because we don't want to mistake Krishna's pastimes. We want to understand them fully and properly. So this is the duty of all of us, to study Prabhupada's books. And Prabhupada points out, as Shukadeva Goswami points out, you must begin from the beginning. Right? Don't go straight to the 10th canto. Just like we're studying in our Bhakti Vaibhava course, we're studying the Bhagavatam. We finished the first canto, now we're in the second canto. And Prabhupada says it again and again and again and again. You must study this literature categorically. Right? Because if you jump straight to the 10th canto, you'll make all these mistakes. Oh, why is Krishna dancing with gopis? But if you've studied it very categorically, very systematically, then you'll understand Krishna as he is. Right? And that's Prabhupada's desire, that we understand him as the supreme controller. So we'll stop here and we'll see if there's any questions or comments on what we discussed. Srila Prabhupada ki.